Well, hello and welcome to Bikescape, episode number 51, May 17th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bikescape. It's been just about 50 episodes or so, and you may have noticed that there have never been any episodes about fatalities or danger or anything like that. It's a conscious decision I've made. We don't talk about helmet laws too much or the dangers of, you know, dooring or ghost bikes or any of that stuff. And it's a conscious decision. Like I said, it's because I think that as dangerous activities go, bicycling has got to be about the safest. There are very few fatalities in comparison to, say, driving, for instance, or even being a pedestrian. And despite all of the dangers that people overlay on top of the activity, the helmets, the bike lanes, all of the fears that people have about cars, about doors opening and people hitting you from behind, it's really very safe. So I've been trying very hard for the last 3 years now to concentrate on the fun part of bicycling, the fun, efficient, you know the drill. So anyway, it's all coming to an end with this episode. There was a terrible tragedy about 2 months ago down in Cupertino. Two cyclists were killed, Christy Goff and Matt Peterson of the Roaring Mouse Bicycle Club. As they were riding on a training ride, they were hit by a police officer coming in the opposite direction, swerved into their lane, and hit them head-on and killed them instantly. And a third cyclist was also injured pretty badly. Now, I didn't know these people. I'm sure that there were people who loved them and cared for them a lot, and it was just an unspeakable tragedy what happened. But I'm here to discuss some other questions that have been coming up among the people who've been following this in the bicycle community. For instance, how are these cases investigated? What happens when there's a police officer involved? How is the investigation different in that case? How does the media cover the accident? And how is it that the general public looks at bicycling as a result? So we're going to explore some of these things in this podcast. First off, we're going to discuss the legal aspects of what happened with the author of Bicycles and the Law, bicycle lawyer, and personal injury lawyer, Bob Mayansky. And then later on, we're going to talk with Leah Shaham, the executive director of the Bike Coalition, to talk about how the media covered it and what we can do to help shape the way the media covers these things in the future. So first, let's go on the Skype and talk with Bob Mayansky. We're here with bicycle lawyer and star athlete Bob Mayansky here. He's on the Skype calling from Portland, Oregon. Bob, this case is kind of bothers me, and I see differences between what I perceive the way the police would handle a case like this if the offender was a civilian, because the person who killed these two people and injured a third person crossed the yellow line and fell asleep. Do you think there was what were the differences in the way the police handled this case because he was a police officer, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know what the differences are, but let's just look at the facts. A police officer killed two people, and you would expect that the reason for his inattentive driving or his poor driving would be the major issue. And of course, we still don't know if they've drawn blood in this case, and we're almost a month away from when it happened.
Huh. So there hasn't been any kind of breathalyzer test, no kind of testing that was happened on the scene?
Well, we don't know. They haven't released any evidence or any of the circumstances. I know that the officer wasn't willing to cooperate in the investigation initially, but since then, that point has been only one of speculation.
And it said in the newspaper article they said that the officer was actually taken from the scene by his fellow officers. He was speaking pretty freely about what happened right after the accident, and he said that there was that he must have fallen asleep at the wheel, and he was complaining about how he was worried about how his career was over and maybe his life was over, and meanwhile these people lie dying on the street. And couple of police officers, friends of his, I guess, came and told him be quiet, and they hustled him away. That's not the usual procedure, would you say, is it?
Well, it's not normal for the police when they approach an accident like that, or a collision scene, to make a determination and decide who to protect. Obviously, we're dealing with police. I mean, police are they're civil servants, they're public servants. Mm-hmm. They watch us, but who watches them?
Right.
Every single. I would submit that nearly every profession and every occupation has camaraderie, and the police department is famous for it. I mean,
it's a difficult job, yeah.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of difficult jobs out there, but what I'm saying is that your best friend does a job or one of your comrades does a job, and you protect them. I mean, you've heard the thin blue line, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And that's in direct reference to police officers covering each other and keeping each other's back. So from the beginning, we have a problem. I mean, I think there's a greater issue here. I write in my book about police bias in terms of taking police reports that involve collisions that involve cyclists, mm-hmm. how it's done in a biased way and an incomplete way. If they're willing to do that for the general public, what do you think they'll do for a fellow officer?
Right. And do you think if this had been a normal case with a civilian offender, what kind of charges do you think would be brought, or what kind of charges are possible in a case like this?
Well, I know I'm an attorney and I'm supposed to know all this stuff, but you know, it varies from state to state. If you're talking about procedural issues that are determined by the district attorney, if I had a case like this, I'd know the answer inside and out. But I'm not really an expert in that area. What I'm an expert at is talking about how the public treats cyclists on the road and how the police treat them and how the judicial system. This case is just, this is one that smacks of all of those issues. I really don't know in terms of the procedure, and I don't think anyone does. When you do find out what the procedure is, you're going to find out that there's a number of subjective elements involved.
Right.
You know, just as there is with probable cause and a reasonable suspicion, two thresholds that police officers use in their determination of when to stop someone and when to arrest someone. Mm-hmm. Well, they both depend on that officer's subjective determinations. So even if we get down to the brass tacks here and we find out what they normally do, it's still going to come down to the subjective determination of the officers that are responding. So it's going to be difficult to get inside that.
And does it move beyond the police department? What about the district attorney? How would we had a case here in San Francisco where someone was killed, and we felt that it was murder in our case, and it was a different case. But it actually took 6 weeks to get the district attorney to bring charge. We actually had demonstrations in front of the police station and in front of the Hall of Justice. And do you think that's something? Is there a sort of a culture of protection in even in the DA's office and in within the, you know, the further up the courts?
Well, I mean, the DA and the police department are on the same team in almost every instance. I mean, the police are out on the streets and the DA's back it up in court. So they're a team already. I mean, that in some cases, when there's problems with the police, you'll have a special investigator from another DA's office come in for that very reason.
Okay.
In terms of your suggestion that protest would help, I'm not so sure, because based on my reading of the comments following the articles about this issue, you'll see there's a repost to every comment. There's the driver's version that says the cyclists shouldn't be out on the road, that it's their own fault. And these are the same people. Having said that, they're not likely to show up and do anything but, you know, troll through discussion groups. They're not going to show up and protest. Right. It really depends on who the big players want, what they want to see happen in this case.
Right. Well, the DA is an elected official, so that does help a little bit. The public opinion does help more than it does with the police department, I guess. But what about judges? How does a judge get chosen? Is that just a simple question? How does a judge get chosen for a case? In the case we had here in San Francisco with Chris Robertson, we had to deal with a retired judge. How do you do that? How do they figure out which judge is going to try a case?
Again, this is highly dependent on your jurisdiction and which court you're in, but typically they're on rotation. That the cases come in, if there's any kind of conflict, they remove themselves. Either party has the option of affidaviting the judge off if they feel there's a conflict. Otherwise, it goes through the normal rotation. Now, there may be some inner workings behind the scenes that I'm not privy to, but if it's a high-profile case, you can be sure it's going to be one of the heavy hitters that wants it. So I'm not sure how that fits into the lottery rotation.
Yeah.
But you can't pick your judge.
No, you don't get to do that, do you? Okay.
No, but you can file an affidavit if you feel a judge won't give you a fair case, but you know another judge is going to have to rule on that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk about the media a little bit, about how you're preparing a column. You told me the other day that about the media response to all of this, and especially an article in the Chronicle. What are you thinking in those terms about how the media has covered this whole case?
Well, you know, John, I am an attorney, but I mean, I've been writing now for several different journals and online magazines for 10 years. So in a way, I'm a journalist as well. And I was very unhappy with a lot of the writing after this horrible tragedy. But what's really bothered me is some of the follow-up articles. And this week, I'm going to be publishing a column in which I discuss one of the San Francisco Chronicle story about cyclists being twice as likely to be at fault.
Mm-hmm.
People should be familiar with that.
Yeah, we'll put a link to it on the website.
Yeah, and this is some research that was done by the journalists in which they determined that, that the cyclists are more than twice as likely to be blamed. The way the article was written, though, it sounded like it was factual.
Right.
And
actually, go ahead.
Yeah, the number one reason that was given was excess speed. Mm-hmm. And to me, that raises a red flag for me, because excess speed means they didn't have any other way to describe it. They didn't want to blame the driver.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, excess speed is not a normal charge against a motor vehicle, and yet they can attain incredible speeds. But it's used as the number one reason for blaming cyclists. It's kind of like, well, the cyclist had a right to the road, and someone backed out in front of him. Well, if the guy wasn't riding so fast, he would have stopped in time. I mean, it's a really laughable excuse. Furthermore, that evidence comes from police making those reports. So you have a circle of logic problem. So I think it was a damaging article, and it shows the undercurrent of bias against cyclists.
Mm-hmm. You see that all through society. But when it comes to the police and they're servants of society, and when it comes to the DA's office, What are ways that you can think of that we can, as activists, do something to improve the relations and to improve their viewpoint on cyclists in general?
Well, one of the things that can help, not after the fact but before the fact, is to develop a relationship with the police department before you need them.
Mm-hmm.
Some police officers ride bikes. Some police departments have bicycle forces. If you're if you have a cycling group and you can get coordinate with the police department in one of their cycling programs, they're going to see your face, they're going to know your personality, and they may, it may change their view of cyclists. The other thing is to hold people accountable when they violate the law and take it up with the police department, bring your evidence in front of them, and demand that they ticket drivers that are violating your rights or that are harassing you. That might backfire. They may consider you as a nuisance at that point. But in the communities like the one I live in Portland, and I think it's the same in San Francisco, when the police department realizes that you have a big group and you're active and you're reasonable citizens, you can definitely change their perspective.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the things that the Bike Coalition did here was they created a video. They worked with the police to make a video that to be shown during the training sessions, how to deal with bicycle accidents, or bicycle crashes, I should say.
Exactly. It's the interaction that I'm pointing to that can have a good effect.
Right. I also wanted to draw attention to your new book. What made you decide to write a book about bicycle law? Did you see a gap in the? Is this part of the whole campaign?
Absolutely, there was no book. When I look up, do the research for my column or for my own personal cases where I represent cyclists, I had to look up each and every case as a new issue. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if there was one source? And so that got me started. But the thing that really triggered the writing of the book was the issues that we're talking about right now, which is the bias against cyclists, the harassment, the right to the road, these fundamental issues of cycling that I didn't see anywhere in the literature. It's all over the internet, and great groups like the San Francisco Bike Coalition are at the front, but I didn't see anything in the way of a publication, so that's what I set about doing.
Well, I'm about halfway through it, and it's an excellent book, and I really appreciate you putting it together. It's going to be a great resource. And I encourage people to take a look at it, and especially if you're into activism and you're in a community where these things come up.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. You know, I do have a section in Chapter 5 about police bias, so we're dead on with what's happening around the country. And I've got some other people that I've represented. I'm going to write a column about them coming up, and they were riding their bike legally. And they got hit from behind just like this. They didn't die, but their story is going to show you that the same issues seem to happen everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
The police will blame the cyclist, the media will report it incorrectly, and the public will get the wrong idea about what happened and who was to blame.
Yeah, it's a matter of civil rights on the road.
Absolutely.
All right, well, I really appreciate you being on Bikescape, and it's been really great to have you. And you've shown a lot of patience with my technical issues, which seem to have worked out in the end. So thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Well, in the wake of this crash, there was a lot of press. And the newspapers understandably covered the story because it was a sort of a man bites dog story with a police officer causing the deaths of these two people. But on the other hand, there was a certain amount of front page screaming headlines that were just pretty amazing. Sheriff's deputy hits cyclist, killing two. It goes up in volume as the days go by. The bicyclists blamed twice as often as drivers. Bay Area's 25 deadliest roads for cyclists. Bicycle fatalities on the rise in the Bay Area. These are the kind of headlines that came up as a result of this. These two people getting killed and through no fault of their own. So I thought it would be a good idea to go to see Leah Shehum, who's the executive director of the Bicycle Coalition here in San Francisco, and talk to her. She's an expert on the media, and she deals with it all the time, and she's a trained journalist. So we decided to talk about how the media in San Francisco and probably around the country and the world treats cyclists. So we're here with Leah Shehum, executive director of the Bicycle Coalition here in San Francisco. And it's been an interesting couple of weeks, hasn't it?
It has been busy, yes.
So I wanted to talk to you about the media and how it's portraying cycling. And what are they up to? It seems like they're trying to foster some kind of mythical war between cyclists and bikes. Do you think that's happening? Is there a war between bicyclists and cars?
I think the media is fanning the flames a lot more than the reality.
Does it sell papers?
It must. I mean, I don't know if anyone's really reading the Paper Chronicle, though, so that's a question to begin with. I think they even have their own doubts about, you know, how many people are reading the paper itself, but...
You're a journalist, aren't you, by trade,
right? I did study journalism. Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I mean, even some reporters I talk to at the Chronicle, when I complain about some of their poor coverage and the editorial bent they take on bike issues at times, even some of their own reporters say to me, oh, don't worry, nobody even reads our paper. You know, I think there's such an attitude about that. But, I mean, there's no doubt that they have, the Chronicle in particular, though I've also seen some ugly stuff from the Mercury News, and then we've seen TV and radio pick up on all of it. It all feeds off each other, that they've gone into this, you know, bizarro either-or, you know, bike versus car discussion, all out of reaction from the terrible, terrible Cupertino tragedy from a few weeks ago, which, as we know, had nothing to do with bicyclist behavior. No one is suggesting that the bicyclists who were killed in that terrible tragedy in Cupertino did anything wrong.
Right, you know, yet it turns into a bicycle safety story.
Absolutely. Time and time again, you know, it seems like I'd say, you know, 75% of the discussion around the media and the public dialogue churned by the media has been about bicyclist responsibility, bicyclist behavior.
So how did that take shape? There was the original article about what happened, but then there were things about that article that were kind of odd. Do you remember anything that stuck out at you? It was one where they were talking about how that road is tempting to bicyclists, is one thing that Bob picked up on in the Mercury News.
That's a great point. Yeah, some of the words they used, you know.
As if bicyclists don't belong on that road.
Yeah. Some of the words used in one of the articles by the Mercury News talked about, you know, the driver, who ended up being a police officer of all things, you know, on duty, police officer, that the police officer, you know, veered across the road, and that, you know, the bicyclist, I forget how they worded it exactly, but it almost implied that the bicyclist banged into his car. You know, this is a motorist who went across the line and drove illegally and recklessly head on into traffic.
Possibly impaired, we don't really know, because he was never really tested properly.
You know, you just wonder if this had been a car-car collision, a head-on car collision, like there was, sadly, on the Golden Gate Bridge recently, what would the coverage have been like? Would it have been very different than if a bike was involved? And I would say, yeah, there would be. I feel like there's a real blame the victim attitude in this case, even indirectly, but it's coming out because it was a bicyclist. They were bicyclists.
And they were, I guess, one of the things they quoted people that I don't understand why they quoted certain people in the first place, but the quotes had a lot to do with, oh, I've seen bicyclists disobeying the rules.
Right.
Or I've seen bicyclists riding recklessly.
Yeah. And even frankly, you know, talking...
Or I've seen them riding two abreast. That was a big one. I've seen that several times now.
You know, I know that they've interviewed a lot of people who are, you know, who are bicycling enthusiasts, recreational bicycling enthusiasts, and who are like team captains or trainers or something. And they've gotten their quotes saying things like, oh, yeah, we really, you know, we really emphasize, you know, obeying the law and education and stuff. And that's great, and you should. I'm all for obeying the law and education. But that shouldn't be the story right now. Yeah. You know, now is the opportunity to talk about motorist responsibility, to talk about dangerous driving, people who are distracted while driving. These things are really dangerous. Why aren't we talking about that in the media?
And it's true. There was a head-on collision on the Golden Gate Bridge. It happens every couple of years now. It was pretty gory.
Yeah.
The first thing that the newspapers talked about was how we have to build it. We have to make that road safer for cars.
Yeah.
It didn't talk about fault at all, let alone...
You know, in a very similar situation where it sounds like, in the Golden Gate Bridge case, it sounds like a driver veered across, cut across the cones, who knows why, but, you know, dangerously, illegally went into oncoming traffic. Yet the tone of that article is so different than the bike situation, and it's almost as if, again, there's this blame the victim and sensibility in the media.
Another bit of the subtext is about one is blame the victim, and another is just how dangerous it is to ride a bike.
It's a great point.
You know, what are you doing in the road anyway? Yeah. It's so dangerous. Why are you doing something so stupid and dangerous?
Yeah.
How dangerous is it?
And
really,
it's so much safer than people think. I mean, it's amazing to me. There's study after study showing that, hey, bicycling is becoming more popular, more frequent, and with those numbers comes greater safety. It's undeniable that there is safety in numbers when it comes to bicycling.
Somehow the newspaper took those very numbers and made it seem like it was more dangerous.
They turned it opposite. Yeah, it was amazing to see. You know, one of those stories, I think it was the Aaron McCormick Chronicle story.
These were big front page stories,
too.
Yeah, big
front page stories. You know, the headlines were screaming, the graphs and the pictures were all implying this bicyclist bad behavior tone. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that her story talked about was fatalities going up in the Bay Area, bicycle fatalities going up in the Bay Area. That was the, you know, the lead story. Well, you read further down, and all of a sudden you said, well, collisions have gone down significantly, and injuries have gone down significantly. Well, that seems of note, right? Mm-hmm. That's interesting. But she kind of buried it in the story. And to me, most importantly, there was no context for that story. If indeed more people are being killed in the Bay Area on bikes, does that have anything to do with the huge growth of bicycling? I mean, let's say bicycling grew by 100%, yet you had X number of additional deaths. That does mean something. I mean, you can't just think about it as pure increase of ramifications without thinking what's the denominator of so many more people biking.
Right.
And what I think is interesting in San Francisco, she studied the whole Bay Area in her reports, but in San Francisco, it's been the opposite of what she's implying, but that there's proven numbers to show more people are biking, and the fatalities, deaths, and injuries are going down. So it's really clear the rate of fatalities, injuries, and deaths is going down. It's getting safer.
About one fatality a year, give or take. And how many people ride? We have a city of 800,000.
Yeah.
And how many people, what percentage rides?
Fantastic numbers that show 16% of San Francisco adults bike at least a couple times a week for transportation. And these are people who were asked a question in a professional poll in November 2007, very recent. They were asked the question of, do you bicycle in San Francisco for transportation? It was trying not to include the recreational riding, just so we could really get at the everyday means transportation. 4% of those said, I bike daily. So that's people like me and you who are biking pretty much every day. Mm-hmm. Another 12% said at least once a week.
You can feel it outside, anecdotally. You can feel it out on the street, especially when the weather gets nice this time of year.
You know, nobody denies that. Well, actually, maybe Rob Anderson. But everybody else in the world, you know, just anecdotally, like you talk to somebody at the grocery store, at a restaurant, or, you know, your neighborhood, everybody says, wow, there's so many more bikes on the street. I mean, it's undeniable.
And with that, theoretically, the larger number of bicyclists makes it safer.
Absolutely. I mean,
that's been the case in the Netherlands and in
study
Europe.
After study shows, you know, all over Europe and in Portland they've seen it as well. Mm-hmm. And now here we're seeing it, that there is safety in numbers. And, you know, that makes sense. Think about it. We're more visible. Drivers know, you know, we're all more predictable.
And many of the drivers are becoming cyclists nowadays.
Exactly.
So they know what it feels like to be behind the handlebars, which is a big change from 10 years ago.
I think there's this huge difference in that it's less other, it's less different, right? So, you know, more people are biking sometimes, so they get it, but more people know people who bike, right? Mm-hmm. I think when there are people out driving, they look and they see a bicyclist and they think, oh, that could be my neighbor, that could be my dentist, that could be my teacher. You know, it's not this idea of this tiny segment of the population who feels very other and foreign to you.
But you still see in the comments on the online version of the Gate, the San Francisco Chronicle, you still see these comments that are so predictable in the language.
Yeah.
They even use word for word what I've been hearing for years. Like, I can't imagine the number of times I've stood at the corner and watched bicyclists not stopping at the stop sign. That exact string of words, you always hear it. Or, you know, if the bicyclist would just ride safely, they would get my respect. Or if the bicyclist would pay their share of the road taxes, they would get my respect.
Yeah.
And so it does, this kind of journalism does have an effect on people.
I don't know if it has an effect. I mean, I would say that the kind of people who spend their entire day blogging on the SF Gate website, you know, I don't know that these people's minds are changed by the Chronicle one way or another. You know, I don't know if these people are thinking differently. You know, I think the kind of people who spend all day on the blog are probably pretty set in their ways in some ways. I don't know if this is new opinion or if it's just fanning the flames of, frankly, a vocal minority of people who are cranks about a lot of different issues, biking being one of them.
Yeah. Well, okay, so it seems like the Chronicle, the Mercury, the TV stations, they do thrive off of conflict. That's what the TV and, you know, the mainstream media is all about. Lately, we've been seeing articles the last couple of days about how the bike plan is starting to take shape.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's a connection, if this is some kind of campaign to slowly build up. Am I paranoid? Do I think that the media is about to come out against the bike plan?
I don't know. I mean, I think you're right.
First of all, could you for the listeners, just tell us what the bike plan quickly in like two sentences?
Sure. Just, you know, the bike plan is a plan to really make the city great for biking. Lots of recommendations for new bike lanes and better education and encouragement and bike parking and access to transit, all those sort of good things.
And integrated.
really well integrated citywide. It definitely doesn't get at everything, but it gets a lot of what we need to make this place really primo for biking. And right now it's in this holding pattern, most folks know, because the city's been sued.
You mentioned Rob Anderson,
yeah,
who's the guy that sued the city.
A couple of cranks have sued the city and have put this bike plan basically on ice for a little while the city conducts an environmental review. And of course, that's really ironic that anyone's questioning the environmental benefits of bicycling. Right now there's been a lot of discussion about, okay, how does this environmental review get done? How quickly does it get done? And we want it done quicker, but when it's done, what does the bike plan look like and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. So I think you're right that I don't think the bike plan getting reintroduced this week would have gotten as much coverage that it did without the fanning of the flames that's happened over the last couple weeks.
One of the things I saw in the article was they made a point funny thing about journalism is you're supposed to tell two sides of the story even when one side of the story is a lot smaller than the other side of the story. They have to be given equal weight. But they mentioned Rob Anderson, the crank. And
I think he's the only person they can really find to speak out against these things.
And they mentioned that this bike plan would make things wonderful for bicyclists and safer and more attractive, yet it would take away parking and some traffic lanes.
Yeah.
And if you want to have your voice heard about this thing that's happening in our city without you knowing about it, maybe until just now, you should go to the big bike plan talk
meeting that happened
the other night.
It's very well attended.
Make sure your voice is heard. And I think they were implying that you should, you know, if you're worried about your lanes disappearing to bicycles or your parking spot in front of your house.
Yeah, I think there's this belief, among the media that, you know, freaks people out more than probably anything else, you know, and they may be right to a degree on that, but I don't think they're as right as they think. I mean, it's, you know, anytime you mention parking removal, that's just gonna, you know, get people all hot and bothered and read the papers more and go out and do things and read the papers more, you know. I don't think it's going to be as big a deal as they're fanning it to be. I mean, here's an example. Looking at, you know, just the last 10 years, San Francisco has actually conducted almost 30, probably at least two dozen road diets. And that's where you basically literally put a road on a diet. Like Valencia Street, most people are familiar with, used to be four traffic lanes. Mm-hmm. Now it's two regular traffic lanes, a middle turn lane, and the bike lanes. That was really controversial back in the late 90s, right? We all had to fight really hard for that. And it was, once it was done, it was like this wonderful thing everyone loves and rejoiced. Well, there's been another two dozen streets like that. You know, Alamany, Arguello, pieces of Polk Street, pieces of Howard Street, a lot of streets that have had mostly traffic lanes. It's less often parking. Mostly traffic lanes removed in order to accommodate better bike travel. And time and time again, it results in a better street. You're not seeing drivers backed up and screaming. It's not happening.
And
San Jose Avenue is a great example.
You end up with a neighborhood that actually functions
better. Yeah. Potrero is a great example. I mean, I love the Potrero example because, you know, this was a great bike improvement because it added bicycle lanes on this crazy ass street that used to be six lanes, you know, wide. Now it's four regular lanes with a middle turn pocket and the bike lanes. But the people who love it most are people who are walking across that street to San Francisco General Hospital to get their service. You know, there's people waiting for the bus and now they're not feeling as intimidated by six lanes of traffic. It's people who live on that street who it used to feel like a freeway to them and now it's not the best neighborhood street, but it's a little more like a regular street. I mean, these time and time again, these bike improvements end up being so much bigger, so much more about traffic calming, neighborhood safety, and just livability.
So how do we impart that to the media so that message gets trumpeted instead
of giving
the city away to the bicyclists is what it seems like.
One thing I'd love is the city, you know, the city of San Francisco, and that's, you know, city leaders like the mayor and the board of supervisors and the head of the municipal transportation agency. I'd love them to be more proud and more loud about what they want, mm-hmm. about the vision of a safer, more bikeable, more walkable, more transitable city. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't just be advocates asking for these things. It needs to be our city leaders. It needs to be our neighborhood leaders. You know, people need to start stepping up and saying, hey, we've done these things. You know, I cite that statistic of 24 or so streets have gone on road diets. Where's the city saying that? You know, I mean, they need to step up and start taking credit for, frankly, the good things that they've done. Now, granted, they've usually done them under duress because advocates have, like, pushed their, you know, nose to the wheel, but they've done them and they've been really successful. So stop hiding this stuff. Start putting it out there. Start being proud. Start talking about not only your vision forward, but your successes in the past. I think that would go a really long way so that the media is not thinking this is some advocate's pipe dream. It's not. It's actually, you know, these ideas of a mode, major mode shift to get more people walking, biking, and transit, these are all things that are written up in the city's general plan, the city's transportation plans, the city's climate action plan. These are not wild things. These are city mandates at this point.
Yeah, and as the price of gas goes up,
yeah,
we'll see it. You know, people will be very thankful that it happened. That
absolutely.
That groundwork. Well, thanks a lot for being with us. I really appreciate you making some time to be
Yay.
On the Bikescape.
Thank you, John. Thanks for getting bikes out there.
All right. Well,
it's great. Happy riding.
Okay.
Ring, ring.
Okay, well, thank you, Leah, and thank you, Bob, also. And I want to remind everybody, if you don't know, Bob writes the excellent column in the Velo News called Legally Speaking, where he tackles the legal questions of the day as they relate to bicycling. So check him out over at velonews.com. As I said earlier in the show, doing a show about a tragedy like this kind of worried me because it's one of those things that we bicycle activists fall into a trap of, I believe, of making bicycling seem more dangerous than it is, because we emphasize the danger of cycling when we advocate for things like bike lanes and whatnot. And I really want to emphasize, really, because bicycling is about the safest activity there is. It's much safer than driving. And because people feel the need to wear helmets because they think it's dangerous, and the need for bike lanes, I think bike lanes are a great thing, by the way, especially for people who are still learning to ride. It's important to realize that bicycling is a safe activity. And statistically, it's been proven over and over again that, you know, you may be more likely to break a collarbone, but as to die on a bike, it's very, very rare, especially in comparison to driving. In fact, I would suggest if you drive a car, you really should wear a helmet at all times. Anyway, let's move on to other things, shall we? Here's a clip from the Kunstler cast, a new podcast from James Howard Kunstler.
Well, Jim, would you mind if we do a little Kunstler glossary of terms of sorts?
Yeah, if you can come up with one, sure. I'll see what I can do.
All right, well, I'll tell you, I'll sort of come up with the expression and you explain to our listeners what it means, okay? Let's start with parking lagoons. What are parking lagoons?
Well, that one was perhaps a little ironic because, you know, the word lagoon kind of evokes a lovely kind of tropical, place that you'd like to hang around. And, you know, you're on your yacht and, you know, it's a lovely kind of place. Whereas the parking lot is the opposite of that. It's, you know, it's a demoralizing, repellent place. And so I was just trying to, you know, mess with people on that one.
You can park your yacht-sized car in the parking lot.
Right. Well, yeah, you sort of, that I think was an implication of it.
That was an excerpt from a podcast recently done by James Howard Kunstler. He's got a new podcast. He's got about 5 or 6 episodes up right now. They're all pretty interesting. He gets his friend Duncan to throw softball questions, and he gets to expound at length about them. If you don't know who James Howard Kunstler is, Jim is a acknowledged authority on the, or a great popularizer of the notion of peak oil, which is the idea that we have already gotten to the highest point of our oil production. Now we've leveled off. We're not quite sure where the peak is, but a lot of people are guessing it's right about now for the world. The United States passed peak oil back in the 70s, but the world seems to be hitting its peak right now. And it doesn't mean we're running out of oil. We got plenty of oil left. But what it means is that production has leveled off and it's going to start declining in a while. And what that means for society in general, for the economy, for the way we live our everyday lives, is breathtakingly amazing. And you can read about it in The Long Emergency by James Howard Kunstler, or you can also read his new novel called The World Made by Hand, which it's a novel, and it describes a world in which we have to actually work for the things we do. We don't have abundant energy supplies to support the kind of growth that we have nowadays that we depend on in our economy. His vision for the future is pretty gloomy, but he's a really funny guy. You'll find his podcast and his blog, Clusterfuck Nation, to be a really funny blog about serious issues and kind of scary issues. He has a very scary image of the future, and I haven't been able to disprove it. But he goes on later on in the podcast that we listened to describe. Duncan asked him, why is your stuff so funny? And Kunstler answered with a quote from Beckett, Samuel Beckett, saying that there's nothing more funny than unhappiness. And what brought this up for me was because on a very funny show, The Colbert Report, Kunstler was asked to be a guest. And I thought that was pretty funny that James Howard Kunstler was a guest on The Colbert Report. And unfortunately, I don't think he watches much TV. I don't think he knew what The Colbert Report was about. And he tried to be funny, but I don't – he as Fritz from Psycholicious left in a comment, he said that his jokes kind of fell flat. But you can catch it on my blog. I put a clip of it on bikescape.blogspot.com. Check it out. And in other news, well, I hope you all enjoyed Bike to Work Day around the country and around the world. It's something that's been going on the week of May 16th, this last past week that we just had. I know that bicycles outnumbered cars. You know, every year the Bicycle Coalition does a count on Market Street, the main drag of San Francisco, and they count how many cars and how many bicycles. This year there were 2/3 of the traffic was bicycles at 9 a.m. On Bike to Work Day, or actually the day before Bike to Work Day. So that is pretty amazing. The weather was really nice. I'm sure that had something to do with it. But every year we're growing by leaps and bounds. Last year, a 15% increase. And this year, I'm not sure. But it's also a big increase over last year. So the times are changing. Now, SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Group, is going to have a forum, Bike to Work Day Report, on Tuesday, May 20th. You may want to check that out. It's at 12:30. Bring your lunch at the SPUR at 312 Sutter Street at the corner of Grant. Just take the elevator up, park your bike outside. Join a report from the organizers of the 2008 Bike to Work Day. Did participation increase from last year despite the injunction against bike improvements? How does the Bike to Work Day fit into other strategies of the Bike Coalition and the Municipal Transportation Agency to promote and encourage bicycle commuting? There's going to be presenters who will include Leah, who we just heard from, the Bike Coalition, and Oliver Gaida, who's the Bicycle Program Manager for the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. So, yeah, bring lunch. It's open to the public, and it's free to SPUR members, and it's $5 for non-members. What else? Oh, this should be fun. You're sitting in your office in front of your computer all the time. You're getting a little antsy. Well, on Wednesday, May 21st, at 12:15 p.m., get out for the Hump Day Lunchtime Power Ride. They're going to greet the midweek with adrenaline. Get out of the office, apartment, or cafe, stretch your legs, and get some fresh air. They're going to meet by the City Hall, head down 8th toward Folsom, up around the Embarcadero, then roll back to City Hall. Try to wear something red so they can you can be identified with each other. Duration of approximately about an hour. Pace slow to moderate, no one left behind. Contact Jess for more details at povertyonwheels.humpday@yahoo.com. And then, let's see, also on Wednesday, say you get back to work and you still feel like doing something kind of geeky. Well, there's the bike plan update, Central City. This is what's going on. There's going to be a bunch of bike, you know, the bike plan is what Leah described. It's going to be having some public hearings all over the city. So on May 21st will be the Central City. May 22nd will be Southeastern City and several other places. You can go to the MTA Bike Program website for more information. There will be a link on the blog. I'll try and remember to put it there at bikescape.blogspot.com. But it's going to be public. The public will be invited, and it will be nice to have some bike advocates there because you might have some people there who are afraid of losing parking spots and or maybe an extra lane that they maybe there'll be a little more car congestion. It's already hard enough to get around by car. You got to give them some sympathy, but got to show them the alternatives as well. You can volunteer with the SFBC at Carnival. Don't miss the kickoff day of San Francisco's Energize Carnival Festival. You can join in the fun as a bike valet volunteer in the Zona Verde, Carnival's eco-friendly zone, the Green Zone. So you want to call VBP Volunteer at sfbike.org. Here's the West of the West ride. Saturday, May 24th, 1:30 p.m. at the Palace of the Legion of Honor in Lincoln Park at Land's End. Let's see, the blurb says, San Francisco is the West's West, but when was the last time you pedaled all the way out to the Pacific Plate? This ride will take a loping, loving look at the city's western edge, stopping to explore curiosities and celebrities along the way, ruins and relics and remarkable riches. It's a two-hour ride. Have a big lunch beforehand. We'll stop somewhere for a snack. Contact info at sfbike.org for more information. Okay, well, I think that's the end of the show. I think I've had enough, and we'll post this thing. There's a new thing. There are many ways to contact Bikescape. You can write to me easily enough at bikescape@sbcglobal.net. You can leave a comment on the blog at bikescape.blogspot.com. And now there's a new way to contact me. You can get on the podcast yourself. I finally set up Skype to receive voicemails, and I figured out a way to record them. How do you do it? You call me on Skype. If you don't have Skype, you should get it. It's great. Call Bikescape. That's the code name. And leave a message. I won't answer because I usually don't have it on, but I will get all the messages, and maybe you'll get on the air. And if you may have some ideas for a show, you may have a little commentary of your own. If I need to edit it, I will, but, you know, I'll make you sound smart, okay? Trust me with the editing. So leave a message at Bikescape on Skype. Now, as we really come to the end of the show, I want to invoke the California Vehicle Code. CVC 21202 says that you must ride to the right side of the road, except under the following circumstances, and I'm paraphrasing here. When you're going at the speed of traffic at the time, not the speed limit, but the speed of traffic at the time, you may take the lane. If you're within 100 feet of a place where right turns are permitted, you may take the lane. If there's any kind of obstruction, say a piece of glass, a pothole, you may take the lane. If the road is too narrow for a car and a bicycle to ride side by side safely, you may take the lane. And there's a whole other bunch of reasons why you should take the lane. What does it mean? You're legally mandated to do what I've been telling you at the end of each show for years. Take the lane. I'm going to close the show with a song that was submitted by a band called Feel It Robot. They found me on Last FM, of all places, and it's a song called Let's Ride Our Bikes.